Welcome to Iowa Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. How are you, my friends? I hope you're well. I've got a really fun episode for you today with Kristen Campbell talking about relationships, dating, and finding love during a pandemic, and how dating has changed over the last 20 years since the shift to online and apps. She'll be up in just a minute. This is episode 80. And if this is your first time listening to the show, I want to welcome you. Highway to Health is a place for you to explore and create your own blueprint for health. Having worked in integrative health for more than 25 years, I'm acutely aware of how all aspects of our lives come to have an effect on our overall state of being. And it's my hope that through the content and conversations you get here, you'll be more engaged and empowered personally and in your communities. And if you're enjoying the content you get here, please consider taking a minute and give us some stars on the app that you're listening to this podcast on right now. Or even better, write a couple of lines about what you found valuable from the episodes that you've heard and help others find us and improve their state of wellness. So this conversation you're about to hear explores a topic that we're all familiar with. It's the subject of no less than a billion songs, movies, and books. And it's perhaps one of the most intensely complex experiences of our lives, and it can happen anywhere and at any time. And to be without it is harmful to our health. Of course, I'm talking about love. Finding love in the time of COVID seems unlikely, but I've been hearing a number of stories about successful matches happening. And I made a special trip out to Denver to talk to Kristen Campbell, sister of one of my close friends, to get her take on what's happening and what she knows about finding your special someone from her work as a professional matchmaker for nearly 20 years. Here is my conversation with Kristen Campbell. When I learned that you were a professional matchmaker, I was so intrigued. So much has changed about the way that we're looking for a partner, and what you're doing feels almost old-fashioned. And all I know about it really is from that show on TV.
Millionaire Matchmaker?
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of.
She used to work for our LA office.
Oh, she did?
Yeah, and then who's the guy? What's his name? Bryan Cranston, who was on Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
He used to work for a company.
Did he really?
He was our videographer. I just realized that in the last few years because I was reading a book of essays, memoirs that he had written.
Yeah.
And he has a paragraph in there about when he used to work for a company. Yeah.
Was he good at it?
He just talked about it being interesting because, again, you never know what's walking through the door.
Yeah.
And so you have all these clients come in and every day it could be, you never know.
He seems like he's got an amazing sense of humor, though.
Yeah, he does.
Which I imagine you have to have.
You really do. And you also have to have a good poker face, so it makes sense that people that go into acting came from us.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because you never know what someone's going to tell you, and you don't want to make them feel bad about just confessing.
Yeah.
Or saying some kink or fetish or whatever, and so you have to be able to just, yes, okay, you know, so... So that's also what I look for when I'm hiring staff too, is if they can't keep up, if I can read right through them in the interview, then they're probably not going to be very good at our job. So that's something too.
Well, I feel like in my job, there's a lot of times where I have to, you know, I'm doing intake and I get people comfortable enough to a certain point, they will kind of tell me, you know, all the necessary things, but it almost always goes back to like, you know, what's going on with relationships, what's going on with their family. Mm-hmm. And that stuff comes through very quickly. So I sort of have a sense of like, you know, and then now I work with like multi-generations of families because I work with like babies. I work with, you know, usually at that point, a lot of times the grandparents will come into sessions. So then the grandparent will be like, oh, do you work with this? And yeah, I do. They come to see me. So then all of a sudden, and then for years and years, sometimes I work with families for like, you know, I have some families I worked with for 20 years.
Wow.
So I get to see these and they bring all these different people who are sort of close to them too. So like some of their best friends, their in-laws and all these different people, you really get a sense of like what the whole family dynamic is. So you know how to sort of work with them a little bit more.
That makes sense. I mean, that's kind of something too, where we have long-term memberships. We don't just sign them up for a month at a time. Our shortest membership is a year.
Okay.
Because the honeymoon phase of a relationship lasts roughly 6 to 9 months before you even start to see it for what it is. You're emotionally invested by that point, so it takes time to get out of a relationship if it's not the right one. And then it usually takes a minute to want to start another one. So usually people actually do the longer memberships that are 3 years or kind of an unlimited membership so that we take them to the long term goal of getting them to a permanent relationship.
Right.
So, yeah.
And then do you work with them after they get into the relationship then too?
Not often, because usually by the time they get to a point where they want help,
yeah,
they're years down the road.
Okay.
Because usually those first however many years people, you know. And because we've done so much filtering, people are kind of in the same mindset. They're the same kind of quality of people. So they tend to be more compatible right off the bat too.
So what's the typical client like for you guys?
Well,
and it's different. And you've worked in how many different cities now?
Yeah, so I've worked in seven. My boss will tell you eight because I actually ran a center remotely for a while. So, but I didn't spend a lot of time in that city.
So which cities now?
Minneapolis, Orlando, Jacksonville, Milwaukee, Seattle, Indianapolis, Denver, and Cleveland.
Okay.
So all the way across the country.
Wow.
Yeah. And usually Minneapolis is where I was the longest. That was about almost 4.5 years, but most of them have been 1 to 2 year stints at a time.
Do you see any different patterns in any of the places, like within each place?
Oh, every demographic is slightly different in its own weird way. Like Seattle is very I. And coming from the Midwest type of conversation where it's give and take.
Yeah.
And like they say something and you relate to it with some sort of personal experience because it's showing I was really listening and I can also relate. Seattle people just look at you like, this is about me. Why are you talking? And so that took a little bit of an adjustment out there. But I think that's sort of a West Coast thing all the way down because that's really where therapy took off back in the like the 70s, 60s, 70s. And so it was this whole culture on the West Coast of you need to talk about you and like talk through your stuff. And so I think that kind of has some residual effect on just the culture and society in those places.
So I'm curious, just living in Minneapolis, what was Minneapolis like in that respect?
Minneapolis was interesting because as we were kind of talking about earlier, they're more frugal and we're not cheap.
Yeah.
But they have very good credit scores. So like they're financially responsible and all of those things where, you know, they can put it on a credit card. It's just whether or not they will because of the frugality.
So you have the initial meeting with them or interview, you're interviewing them for whether or not they're going to be a good match to work with your company.
Yes. And so, you know, if they have any violent or sexual crimes in their past or stalking or anything like that, they can't join.
Yeah.
If they are still living with a spouse, they can't, you know, things of that nature. They need to have been separated and have filed for divorce at least a chunk of time.
What's the time period?
Well, if they've been separated for less than 6 months and they haven't filed for divorce, then that's not qualified. Yeah. Like, take a minute, breathe, like, see if...
Does the divorce have to be final then?
It doesn't have to be final, but they have to sign a clause in the contract that says there is no chance of reconciliation, this is a permanent decision. Yeah. Because some people don't get divorced for years due to health insurance reasons.
Yeah.
And so, or some sort of something, or they're waiting until the market gets better to sell a house before they divide assets.
Right. Yeah.
Things of that nature where sometimes divorces take years and it's not because it's acrimonious, it's simply practical.
So take me through what like a typical interview is like. What are your questions like to start?
Well, first off, I just ask if they're nervous or excited, a little bit of both. Because, you know, most people have never done something like this and they're nervous when they come in. I just kind of say that what we're going to do is find out about you. You get to find out about us. We're going to hopefully get you started and get you on with your day either way. Because I imagine at some point you'd like your Friday back.
Yeah.
And then I check their ID, make sure they are who they say they are. We check both a driver's license and a financial ID because anyone under the age of 21 can tell you that you can fake a driver's license.
Right.
And so we also run a credit check. So we're matching up the bank of the card with the their credit check with their name, so that we kind of have a triangle proving that they are who they say they are.
Yeah.
And the credit check also helps me look for red flags, because if all of your cards are co-signed, we got to ask some other questions, because if you're going to put it on a co-signed card, why do you have co-signed cards?
Yeah.
Who's the other person on it? Is it a parent? Is it a spouse? You know, sometimes it might just still say co-signed because you were married and the person died and it just hasn't changed on your credit report.
Right.
So we have to kind of investigate. But I think one of the biggest red flags I found on a credit report was I asked a guy if he had any children and he said no. And I was like, do you want to try that again? And he said, no, I don't have any kids. And I was like, one last shot. Because if you're not honest with me, I'm not going to qualify you for this.
Yeah.
And he's like, what? And I was like, you're in collections for child support on your credit report. And he goes, oh, that kid. And I was like, yeah, not for us. You know, like,
yeah.
They're just things that we, all of these different steps that we take are for kind of weeding stuff out. But then, you know, I ask him how many times they've been married. How long ago was their last serious relationship? When did it end? How long were you together? Why did it end? In the time since that last relationship, how have you been attempting to meet people? And just kind of talking about that. And usually in this day and age, it's usually online dating.
Yeah.
And they usually are just like, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, it's they automatically are like, it's awful.
But you started doing this how long ago?
So it'll be 20 years ago next July, and eHarmony had just come out.
Yeah.
Match.com was just finding traction.
Yeah.
And so like it was really interesting to watch that arc as well, because over the last 20 years, eHarmony was actually good when it started, because they had an hour-long survey you had to fill out before.
Yeah.
They didn't qualify everyone for it.
Yeah.
Then when you were using it, you had to go back and forth three steps with the person that you're interested in before you could see photos. So they were really setting you up to try and find compatibility.
Yeah.
And then they tried to compete with Match.com, and now they kind of lost what their, you know, speciality was. And then Match.com, their tagline for a while was, "It's okay to look." And so then Wall Street Journal came out and did an article about how over 40% of the people on there were married because it's okay to look. And they brought in this element that kind of made it a cesspool of that. And so there was all of these things where we were watching this arc of what started off as a great idea on the online dating and making it more efficient and being able to do it from home, into it was just simply about what can we do? And actually the Match group that owns about, I think like 2,000 of them, got sued last year because they know that every day about half of the people that sign up are not real profiles. And they also, those get mixed into their algorithm, which is used for marketing to bring people in.
Right.
So they're using fake profiles to bring people in. And it, I guess it was a thing. So
at this point for your business, for your company, they're trying to set a specific standard for what they will do that a lot of these companies can't. And part of it is you're not really doing algorithm work.
No, because they have, and one of the great things is that every single person that's a member has to come in person. They have to be screened out.
Yeah.
They have to pass a criminal background check. They have to make an investment of time and money and effort and energy into this part of their life. And they have to show that they have sincerity of purpose in their, you know, in their relationship goals. So it's a whole different level. Plus, you know that the person in the pictures is the same one that's going to show up on the date, because our photographer took the pictures.
Oh, yeah,
for sure. So it's not a picture from before she gained 50 to 100 pounds,
right,
which I always hear about the online, or the guy when the guy used to have hair. And so, you know, you're going to recognize the person in the restaurant, which is a big difference also.
Yeah.
So, and we also do a quick video on each person. So you get to hear what their voice sounds like. You get to hear the kinds of stories they tell. You get to hear how they laugh when they're telling a story versus seeing how they smile in a picture, which is a different part of them.
Oh, for sure.
And so by the time you go on the date, it's taken the first few minutes of a date. So you both know you want to be there.
Yeah.
And so it takes a lot of that ick out, of the nervousness and just leaves kind of room for the good kind of butterflies.
Yeah.
And so it's a whole different kind of dating, because you know you're not going to get to the restaurant and 3 minutes in go, I don't even want to be here. I'd rather be home watching something on my screen.
So how much of it is like visual bit versus like that, you know, listening to things or reading about them? Do they see much for pictures?
They see 5 photos, and it's close up and it's full body. So you like I said, you will recognize them in a restaurant.
Right.
And then there's a profile with it. It's pretty simple and efficient, but we also do work behind the scenes, because all of us are talking about, oh, do you know who would be good with who? And we're giving suggestions and all of that as well. And so stuff that may not show up on a profile, but we remember from interviewing them, is overlapping with someone else you interview. I just had, so last December, I signed up a woman at like the 6th of December. And then on like the 17th, I signed up this guy, and I was like, I know your person. And he's like, nice sales tactic. And I was like, nope, I never say that in the interview unless I really mean it. And I've had a handful of them over the years where I'm like, I know your person. And they just called us 2 weeks ago to tell us that they have a wedding date.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, and there's 66 and 70 or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I get to watch all these people find, oftentimes, like the first great love in their life in their 60s or 70s or 80s or 90s. And because, you know, they got married very young and they stayed in the marriage for a long time. She had been in a marriage, a completely affectionate-less marriage for 25 years.
Yeah.
His wife had died 2 years ago, and they are ecstatically happy together. And it's that kind of stuff that's really fun.
That's so cool. So it's got to be hard though when there's, I'm sure there are people who come in who we might refer to them as like fixer-uppers.
Where yes.
You just know that like this person's been single for too long, or maybe I shouldn't say too long, but a long time. Something that like they get out of sync with what it's like to be living with another person, or to have to, you know, navigate the different things that they're going to have to do, decisions they're going to have to make with somebody else. Is that a pretty common thing? And then what do you do in that situation?
Yeah, we have that absolutely happen. And then we also have the opposite, where some people just have a broken picker. And they don't date in their own best interest.
Yeah.
And we have to help them navigate around that as well. And that's part of why this is helpful for someone like that, is we're weeding out so much of the stuff that wouldn't be good for them anyway, that if someone has a broken picker and there's a room full of people, they're going to pick the lowest common denominator in that room.
Yeah.
If we've taken out all of the lowest common denominator, they're still going to pick the lowest common denominator, but it's levels up from what they usually date.
Yeah.
Things like that. But the fixer-uppers, that's also, we definitely have people who, you know, they've gotten their life so rigid. They know where the remote goes, and they know how they like the towels put away, and they know where everything is in the fridge and how they like it. And, you know, I have a pretty blunt conversation with them in the interview about it, and just say, you know, are you at a point where you can let go of some of these things, and you have your little box that you're living in, and everything's put where you want it.
Yeah.
And you need to be able to break down one of those walls and let her in there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we do get some of that.
Do you tell them that they have a broken picker?
Or straight up.
Yeah.
It's a word we have a conversation about often. And usually when I say it, they go, yeah, that is what it is. I have a broken picker.
What do you think those things are? What is it that causes those kinds of bad decisions?
Sometimes it's childhood.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sometimes, a lot of times, adults haven't had any healthy examples of what a couple's supposed to look like. And so they don't know how to...
Or just a relationship in general.
Or a relationship in general, yeah. And so depending on what they saw growing up, and, you know, how that affected them. Sometimes it's not until they got to adulthood and they had a bad relationship.
Yeah.
Or, you know, sometimes they're too caring and they want to take care of people and they want to help people, and they're too optimistic about it.
Yeah.
And so they get into these relationships with someone who does damage to them. I mean, there's a lot of different ways.
And what people use relationships for themselves, mm-hmm. all, so many different things. Some people need to be taking care of somebody. Some people need to be taken care of. Some people want to like be in a power dynamic that's not healthy, but they think that's what normal is or...
Absolutely. Well, and different people need different things because there are alphas and there are betas and and that doesn't, what I've learned over the going on 20 years of doing this is that things don't divide down gender lines nearly as much as we were told growing up. They really don't, because there are women who want to be in charge and men who don't, and there are men who want to be in charge and women who don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, over the years, what's making you motivated to get started and change this part of your life, I've had women say they miss sex more than men over the 20 years.
Yeah.
And men will specify that they miss intimacy.
Yeah.
And that they'll always be like, I'm not talking about the sex part, I'm talking about that intimacy, that, you know, that closeness with someone.
Yeah.
And so that's been really interesting because it's very, very slanted that I've heard men say intimacy more and women say sex more, specifically.
Yeah, it's interesting because I just being an empathic man, I draw those guys.
Yeah.
You know, like if I'm at a party, my wife always jokes because if I'm at a party, there are certain people who pick up on that and they will just come in and tell me everything, basically. And a lot of times the men are so, and this happens in my practice too, they're so hungry to have the acknowledgement of another man to allow them to have what we probably consider to be their more feminine qualities, to be able to express those things comfortably with another man.
Yeah. I have the same thing where it's like the Peanuts comic strip where Lucy has the little psychiatrist for 5 cents.
Yeah.
And I must have the light switched on and I don't know how to switch it off. People on the streets, I'll be walking down the street and someone will just turn to me and say, my wife left me 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I'm like walking by and I have to stop and like step back a couple of steps. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know we were in session. Like, should we find a place to sit or, you know, and it happens so regularly.
I know.
It's crazy.
Yeah. But I think there's something about having practiced the way that we do in our work where we're able to stay fairly neutral.
Yes.
And, you know, I think I can be in any situation. Also, I think it's part of doing some work on yourself where you know all the messiness.
Yes.
You know, you're not trying to, you know, at least for myself, I feel like I've gone through enough messiness that I can come out the other side and say, well, I accept whatever yours is. And so I think people just pick up on that right away. They know.
Well, and we're also offering what is an intimate space
true,
that is also
true.
A safe space. Because I'm giving them probably the most focused time they've had to where someone is giving them their full attention. It's anywhere from 1 to 4 hours. And we're just talking about them and their wants and their needs. And how often do people have that in their lives?
Yeah.
You know? And so...
And culturally, I think in America, I mean, it's different in different places. Living in New York, I feel like I had a little window. And also, you know, just having spent some time in Europe and I went to school in England, there's a very different sort of way that we communicate and express things.
Yes.
And in New York, you get to see it with like... And I've never lived in California, but I imagine it's the same with Latin culture. There's so much more expressive and touching, and they're sort of like just in your face all the time about the thing that they're feeling. We don't culturally, at least growing up in the Midwest, especially whereas you did, you don't get a lot of that. I found myself like incredibly comfortable with that. As soon as I started meeting people like that, I gravitated towards people like that because whereas I was good at listening to all that, I wasn't necessarily as good at expressing that.
Oh, definitely. And I've had almost all male friends my entire life, and I'm much more of a dude.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
My guy friends will tell you that too. They're like, she's kind of just a dude, and I operate that very much like an American guy.
Yeah.
And so that's always been really interesting when I go over and I spend time in Europe, and. I actually had Italian men tell me, you need to treat Italian men like you would treat a woman. And I was like, interesting. okay, all right, that's a completely different life thought.
Yeah.
And they're very, very affectionate. I had a very guy's guy from, he grew up near Boston, who was living in Florence at the same time I was. And he was always saying, he's like, it's so hard. He's like, I don't even know. Are they gay or are they European? Because they're just so...
Wasn't there a Saturday Night Live skit about that?
Probably, yeah. But because they're so affectionate among men,
yeah,
that he was processing and he couldn't... It took him a minute where he was just like, he's like, I don't care if they are. It's just, I don't know the dynamic. I don't know what I'm, like, if there's a different way I'm supposed to, you know. So that was interesting too.
Yeah. Yeah. I find it, my wife's family is Russian, and the guys come off as being sort of very tough on the surface.
Yeah.
But lots of feelings going on there. And at certain times, like, they have to sort of tell you about all those things. But it's, Even with American men, I don't find that they're able to get to the feeling part very much.
No, yeah, that's really true. And I was making comparison between those two cultures, Southern European and American, just in the dating, where if you took them and put them on a playground, Italians and Southern men or whatever, they just want to play. They don't care. Mm-hmm. If they can't get into the tetherball game, then they'll go over and play hopscotch. And if they can't get in there, they'll go play basketball. If they can't get in there, they're going to go play soccer. Like, they just want to play. And that's how they, like, date. Like, they'll talk to this girl, and if she's not interested, they'll go talk to the next girl. And they don't take rejection in the same way.
Oh, that's interesting.
And
yeah.
Where American guys, they have picked that they want to get into the double dutch game, and they are going to stand there until they can get into that game, and they have picked a goal. And I think that's also where we run into mixed messages in the dating in America versus over there, where they take no for an answer and they just move on to the next.
Right.
Where American guys are like, this is what I've decided. I will be getting into the double dutch game, and you aren't a part of the conversation. You are just the double dutch game. Like, so that was a kind of an interesting realization between the two.
What about generationally? Because I imagine it runs the full gamut, right?
Yep.
What's the youngest people start coming to see you?
Well, it used to be more before online. I went all the way down to 18. And I have signed people up in their late 90s.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, I really have seen all of it. It has been really interesting where the generation of our parents... There was, you know, men were raised not to express emotions.
Yeah.
And so whatever emotion that they were expressing, they only knew how to laugh or be angry.
Mm.
And that's been changing for them over the years. They've kind of like found different ways to express that. And the women were raised just to take care of everybody else and kind of ignore their own needs in that generation. Mm-hmm. And so all these women are always coming in and saying, I don't want to be a nurse or a purse.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's a very clear, like, fear of theirs getting into a relationship. Because most of the time they just spent a long time in a marriage and they did everything.
Yeah.
You know, they did the cooking and the cleaning and the all of the emotional work of making sure the kids' schedules went to where they needed to do their activities. And so they get out of that. And then it takes women a lot longer to want to get into a relationship, usually. I'm much more likely to have a guy come in who's only separated that wants to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas women want to wait till they're fully divorced.
Yeah.
That's been pretty common over the years.
And I would even imagine that it probably takes women longer to, like, feel like they're going to let into the intimacy of the relationship, whereas... I think at least what I've seen, especially with older generations, men will just like fall right into the relationship. But that is not that that's a good or bad thing, but I feel like that's something that I've seen.
They don't know how to be alone in that generation.
Right, right, right.
And again, partially because they had a wife who was doing everything for themselves.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden they have to figure out and navigate how to do everything. And they don't want to be doing everything. So that comes up too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But a lot of times, luckily, now they're taking more time before they get into the next relationship. So they're having to learn how to do their own laundry and things around the house. And
so
they're more self-sufficient.
With the younger generation right now, are they not feeling like they're finding like intimate matches, like long-term relationship matches through these apps?
Well, part of it is that, so over the course of the time I've been doing it, when I first started, pretty much everybody that came in wanted to get married or at least have a permanent relationship.
Okay.
And then over this arc in recent years, people doing searching for dating on Google keywords, mm-hmm. Over 70% of people are searching for casual dating. And so that really has changed. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, when I would ask people when I first started, and I had just turned 24 at the time, so I was a lot younger than the clients I was interviewing.
Oh, yeah.
So, but they would say, you know, I'd say, what was your motivation to do this? Well, I want someone to go out to dinner with, and I want someone to go to a movie with, and I just want someone to talk to. Because the only things that really delivered back then were pizza and Chinese food.
Right.
So, you know, like if you wanted anything other than those two things, a lot of times you had to go out to eat or you had to cook, which, you know, and then movies, like you went to the movies and all of those kinds of things. Whereas all the movies come to you.
Yeah.
You can order anything you want for food and it can come to you. You don't need someone for those activities anymore. And now we have social media because that's come around during the time that I've done this. And that has taken the edge off of where people don't recognize that they're lonely.
Right.
So they have movies to keep them company. They have food to give them comfort. They have social media to take the edge off and like make them feel like they're feeling connected to other humans. And so that's a big part of what's been going on in the last decade is that people don't understand, they don't recognize their own loneliness where they did when I started and they were doing something about it.
Yeah.
And so that's a difference too. And you got to keep in mind these online dating sites. I mean, the most common place people use them is either sitting on their couch or their toilet. So, I mean, this is not putting effort in to start a relationship or seek somebody out.
Right.
There's no effort. And so if the conversation falls off with someone tonight and you fall asleep and you go watch a movie or you get bored, there was no investment to begin with. So you're not going to work to progress it.
Well, and it's easy now not to feel like you're like you can keep yourself engaged so that you don't necessarily feel bored.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean you're not lonely.
Exactly.
Because I mean, I've I had a guest on who said that there was a study that he told me about that the average person needs about 6 hours of they were sort of looking at whether social media helped this loneliness epidemic that you know is going on, and that people actually need about 6 hours of in-person time a day, but the in-person time didn't necessarily need to be, you know, directly with somebody. It could be sitting in a cafe, at a movie theater, just being amongst other people, the sense of where you are in the community or how you, you know, sort of feel in combination to your environment or whatever, that was something that was a clear need that they found that the social media wasn't solving for them.
Because you need that energetic connection between human beings.
Right.
That makes sense.
Eye contact and just all the little pieces you pick up when you're just sitting looking at somebody, mannerisms, just feel that you kind of get from being with somebody that you can't really pick up, you know, through. And I know you have a blog, so you're engaged there quite often too. And I've gotten to see a lot of the interactions, and it's fascinating. And people are desperate to connect. You can sort of tell. But I don't necessarily.
Sometimes negatively.
Well, it's sometimes negatively. But it's sort of like with kids. Like there's no such thing as bad attention.
Right.
It's just attention.
And sometimes I think that some of these people who are consistently doing negative, contrarian responses to every other post that comes up, and it's just like they've somewhere along the line learned that if they pick a fight, they'll get attention that they wouldn't otherwise get.
Oh, that's interesting. So with a new person coming in, are they expressing often that there's like what are the needs that they're looking for? Is loneliness part of that equation? Is it intimacy? We have this fairy tale thing going on in American movies and stories and everything that makes us think that love is this like ultimate thing between you and one other person.
Right.
That if we don't have that in our lifetime, that there's something unfulfilled.
Well, there is definitely that. I mean, people talk about the end of a marriage being a failed marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've never been able to buy into that idea because it didn't fail. It reached its end point.
Right.
It was just simply done. And so I get that conversation comes up a lot where, you know, I've had a failed marriage or I've had more than one failed marriage or my relationships have all failed. Mm-hmm. They didn't fail. You came to the end of that relationship.
Right.
And so that's a conversation I have to have very, very often too, because like you said, people think that they're supposed to find their permanent relationship.
Yeah.
And if they haven't found it, somehow that's failure. But you experience and learn and all of these things in every relationship you have, whether it's romantic or friendship or parental or, you know, familial. And you learn these things so that when you do find someone who fits you, you've grown and experienced enough to be able to be that person's partner. Yeah. And sometimes that doesn't come until you're older.
Yeah.
You know?
So are they able to identify that though? Are they able to come in and say like,
some people,
you know, this is what I feel like I didn't do well before. I wasn't able to go deep enough, or I was, you know, too needy or too jealous, or I wanted only that person for myself and I didn't want to share that person. Is that part of what they're able to identify then as they go along?
Some people can articulate that really well.
Yeah.
And other people, I've had people where I say, you know, why did your marriage of 25 years end? And they're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how do you not know? That answer has come more often than I would have expected. Even if it's been years since that marriage ended and they should have had plenty of time where, hindsight would have helped. And a lot of people are just like, I don't know.
Do you ever suggest, or do you have any relationships with like therapists in this field?
I'll sit and have conversations with them and dig in and be like, well, let's talk about it you know, this is something that you might want to figure out so that you don't repeat the same thing. But a lot of times it comes from the older generation, like we were talking about, where women weren't taught to articulate their own needs and wants. And so they were too subtle.
Yeah.
And they felt like they were saying what they needed and wanted for years and not being heard.
Yeah.
And they were being taken care of. So the men were happy. And the men were like, I thought we were happy. No, you were happy.
Right.
She wasn't.
Yeah.
And so that one has come up quite a bit too.
Oh, yeah.
Because again, women anticipate needs. They're raised to look for what someone's going to need or take care of them or, you know, all of these things. And they want someone to also be a mind reader for them.
Yeah.
And so that imbalance causes long-term resentment.
Is that changing generationally now?
It is. So, and even just watching...
At what age point do you think? Are you able to identify that?
Well, definitely we're seeing all of these kids that grew up with social media that are expressing their thoughts and feelings and vulnerabilities just out loud in public are going to have a much different relationship than these people that were taught that you don't talk about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm seeing just in the 20 years I've been doing it, that generation even evolving and being more comfortable in their own skin and changing how they're doing relationships and becoming more partners rather than the man being the head of the household, woman being the, I know there's a Bible term for it. It'll come back to me.
But so the Are they coming to you with a different set of needs then in terms of what they want from a relationship?
In that age range or all across the board?
And like, say, younger men and women?
A lot of times they're wanting, if they come to us, they've gone through the online, they've realized that it's set up for a disposable mindset, interchangeable partners.
Yeah.
It's not people that are looking, like I said, you're not putting any effort in if you didn't even have to put on pants to ask the woman out, you know? And so it's just not set up. Whereas with us, they have to fill something out. They have to take a call from an appointment setter who does screening and filters them out there. Then they have to set an appointment. They have to be responsible and reliable enough to show up for that appointment.
Right.
And then come through, and the interview can take anywhere from an hour to 4 hours, and then make that investment of time and money and effort and energy. And that's before you've ever met anyone.
Yeah.
And so just that, we tend to attract people who are just even more active in their own lives because of that. So the younger people that are coming in, it's because of that. They've been through the online.
Yeah.
They know that it's not going anywhere. They feel like they've wasted enough time, and they're ready to meet someone who actually wants to be their partner in their corner, working towards the same goals in the future, and they want their person.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And do you guys do matchmaking for gay and lesbian, trans, and any other?
We're not ruling it out, but the company itself started in 1976, and it takes some years to get going.
Okay.
And then the AIDS scare happened.
Yeah.
And so there probably wasn't a lot of pivot points during that. And by the time, you know, and then they get to a certain point where we were all kind of like, okay, we kind of get what HIV and AIDS is now.
Yeah.
That's when the online started. And so then they're focused on kind of competing with the online and figuring that out and navigating. So it just never pivoted that way. So it's still the original pretty hetero monogamous relationship.
But if people come in seeking service?
They have, and we'll just tell them, like,
yeah,
we can try and help you, but we don't have the database.
Are there other services that do that you know of?
Not that in real life ones that I've ever heard of.
Right.
Except I think they're maybe in Florida. I think there was in Florida.
Okay.
But I think it was pretty small. I don't know that it got off the ground. But yeah, but there's specific ones for online and things like that. But it just never, like I said, it just never pivoted. And by the time we got to at least where I started working for them, a lot of the other kinds of real life in-person dating services were losing their way at that point because they were trying to compete with the Walmart mentality of quantity versus quality.
Right.
And you can't do that.
Yeah.
And still have the same success.
Right.
So the Walmartian mentality.
The Walmartian.
Yeah.
this time period where we're now, what, 7 months into the pandemic?
Yeah.
COVID times. And is that changing what people are looking for or you know, even how they go out on dates, having to deal with, like, do you have to do anything in relation to testing before people can get together in person, or how are you dealing with that?
Well, we do take everyone's temperature when they walk in the door. They've already taken a questionnaire with the appointment setter on the phone.
Yeah.
And they have to do another questionnaire when they come in because there's time in between those two. And we take their temperature when they come in for photo and video. So if they can't pass the thermometer, they can't come in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we take all the employees' temperatures every day too. So we do a lot of that stuff, which has changed. And when it first started, people were like, yeah, you know, hold off, and I don't know, and who knows what it's going to be like.
Yeah.
And then now people are like, I need to get out there and live my life.
Right.
Like, you can't be that isolated for that long and be healthy.
Yeah.
Because they say loneliness is more detrimental to your health than being obese or smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, it's going to be important. It's going to matter.
Yeah, I mean, just with people I know, some colleagues and some friends who have been dating, there seems to be a lot of good dating going on. Like the matches that I see happening right now seem to be good. And we were talking about earlier before we got on mic about you started doing this after 9/11.
Yeah.
And how people would like that. There was a very specific time period where I think you reassess the value of relationships or of having a romantic, involvement with somebody and being intimate in that way, that if you feel like you haven't had that or you haven't had it in a while, that its value starts to become sort of obvious once all this is going on and you realize life could just, end at any moment.
Well, and the shelter in place, I don't know how long you did it in Minneapolis. The Denver one was roughly, I think, March 25th. And I think we went back to work May 15th.
Yeah.
So during that time, a lot of people were like, oh, I need to do something about this part of my life.
Yeah.
Because, when you're just sailing through day to day and you're getting up and you're going to work and you're coming home and watching
you're busy, you're full scheduled.
Yeah. But all of a sudden, you have to hit the pause button and you're looking around your house. You're going to make an assessment and kind of make some changes.
Yeah. You're just spending that time with yourself.
Yeah.
You hear this sort of the metaphor of being like war, and I think we were sort of joking, talking about like love in the time of COVID,
yeah.
Like the time of cholera,
yeah.
And there's something that happens, to the Casablanca story, to all these things. There's something that just becomes so much more intense about the feelings that you feel during these times, and I think some of that comes up through the isolation. But then it needs an outlet too.
Well, and I think the factor of social media in people's lives, all of a sudden it's filling up more time because you're at home and people are realizing, okay, that's not feeding you
because right.
you're not even going to the office and having conversations with coworkers.
Right.
All of the, at least, and like you were saying, 6 hours of just being around humans.
Yeah.
People weren't going to the grocery store.
Yeah.
People weren't going into the bank. They weren't going into these places. They weren't even going in to pick up carry out food. Like it was coming out on to meet you on the curb.
Yeah.
So like all of the even just normal energy input from just passing by other people
yeah.
is no longer there.
Yeah. So do you have any like for someone starting to think about, I wanted to have this conversation with you because it just feels like a moment right now where I think a lot of people are going through all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any advice in terms of like what to do for yourself in this situation? Obviously a place like yours is kind of boutique-y in some way.
And it is. And it's not cheap.
Yeah. But there are things that you must advise daily that might help somebody in this situation too.
Well, and that, to go back to the COVID thing too, people are still really nervous about meeting people. So they are wanting it so badly, but they don't know what the risk versus reward is. And, you do something like what we do, we're weeding people out and on the fact that these are more responsible people. They're more,
true.
They're more financially stable. They are more likely to do what they say they're going to do, all these things. So that's also kind of filtering out the risk to some extent also, just to circle back to that thought.
Yeah, yeah.
Part of it is just you got to be willing to put yourself out there and just, you can get out and just go for a walk with someone on a date. It doesn't have to be sitting in a restaurant. It doesn't have to be something that even has very much risk to it, you know? And it's for grownups. If you ask someone to take an STD test before you're intimate with them, you can ask them to take a COVID test.
True.
I mean, it's the same level of responsibility.
Yeah.
You're just asking someone to protect you from their choices.
Yeah.
And that's an absolutely okay, responsible adult thing to do.
Do people come in with that concern in terms of finding a partner and having the risk of any STDs?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Is that part of the questionnaire? Or do
it's
you guys
not
go
part
into
of the questionnaire
that?
Because I think they say that over half of sexually active adults have had an STD at some point in their lives.
Right.
So, I mean, it's part of that. And that's why you have people have tests.
Yeah.
But actually, the people who are increasing in STDs the most are like in their 70s and 80s.
No, I've heard this.
Yeah. I mean, those are the people that are passing it around and getting wild. So
yeah. Yeah.
I imagine it's partially because there's no risk of pregnancy, so they don't think of condoms and various
right,
other
right.
things. And, you know, they didn't grow up having those conversations. But yeah, I mean, that's something I'll have I'll have that conversation with people and just say, you're an adult. You're going to be dating adults. Just have the conversation.
Yeah.
Communication is key to everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Everybody's got a concern or a hang up or whatever that I'm sure part of your role is to help them navigate this and get comfortable with those kinds of things. And even just in terms of, you know, what we've talked about before is finding a person is not necessarily the final end goal here either. I mean, we're learning about ourselves in the process of all this. We're trying to make a match for ourselves, but how are you going to do that if you don't just get out there and get to know people and get to know who you are, you know, in relationship to different kinds of people?
Well, and like we were talking about a minute ago, you can't match with the right person if you haven't learned enough of the things that will help you match with that person either.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes it takes a 10-year marriage and to figure out a lot of things about yourself, of what you do want and what you don't want.
Right.
And they say that people do the most changing in their adult lives between the ages of 18 and 25.
Mm-hmm.
So if you picked your person during that and you haven't quite, you know, filled out your skin and stretched into where you want to go, and sometimes that causes you to go in the wrong direction and you stick with it because you love that person, but love is not enough to make a relationship work.
Yeah.
It's just not. You can love them infinitely and they still might not be your partner.
Right.
You know?
And that's the thing I always think is interesting too, is that, you know, people deciding they want to go into a monogamous relationship or you know, develop a long-term monogamous relationship, it's a ton of compromise. And, you know, there are some people who go into it thinking that they're going to kind of get things figured out in that intro period,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to see everything about this person and that's going to be it. But we're constantly growing through this process.
Hopefully,
you know, or we're devolving, whatever the case, but we have to keep kind of like adjusting to that and kind of reasserting what our needs are at every step of the way. And it's daily. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, every single day of your life, you're with this person. It's different than a friendship where you kind of take breaks and get back together and catch up. You're caught up all the time.
Absolutely. And that's one of those things too, where, that's something that's finally evolving for men. As you were talking about earlier, men crave that ability to be vulnerable and intimate with other men
mm-hmm.
in a completely platonic way.
Yeah.
But for so long, men only had the woman in their life. That was the only person they were telling secrets. That was the only person they were telling their wants, their needs, any vulnerability. And that evolving, I think, is going to lead to healthier relationships in partnerships too. Men being able to, because you see these men come out of, like, either their spouse died or they got divorced. They no longer have a person to tell anything.
Yeah.
And so that's part of why they're more motivated to get into a relationship again, because they don't have a place to put that.
Yeah.
And everybody needs a person.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because like on the vulnerability side with men, I know that there have been generations of men certainly men who served in wars together,
mm-hmm.
you know, where they basically were having to, you know, deal with each other every single day, who developed these quite intimate relationships with, and they end up keeping those relationships usually for their entire lives. And I think, I mean, it's still true to this day, but I think that, you know, maybe military service has changed in some ways, and the way that, you know, people do it as a job or the way that they kind of get into it. There were points where you just kind of got thrown in and had to like deal with each other. And I think that was one place. And I think it happens with men a lot of times in sports and things like that too. Yeah. Those are the only places that I've ever seen it in my life as a musician.
I was going to say musicians and theater people too.
Yeah. You kind of have to do that like pretty early on. Almost every like good musician relationship I've had comes down to the fact that we are able to explore all those things. You know, we're able to like express something together. And sometimes it's not even through communication. The music sometimes just like pulls these things out of you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes you get done with a creating something with somebody else and you feel it and it's like, oh, that was intense.
Yeah. And you're connecting on a different level. And we need more of that in the world and in our society right now.
Yeah.
To circle back to your point about the war, so the owner of my company, he actually met his wife through the dating service and then started buying them.
Hmm.
And they've been together for 30-some years. They have a couple kids. Like, they're really adorable. But his parents have one of my favorite love stories. His dad was a POW from Italy where they had a POW camp here in America in Michigan, which I didn't know this until years ago when he told me this story. And his mom had happened to be over visiting some cousins in New York when the war broke out and she couldn't get back. So then she went to stay with some other family in Michigan. And we held dances for the POWs. And they met at a dance for the POWs.
Wow.
And there was about 8 couples that all met through these dances and these activities that they had for POWs that we brought to Michigan for some reason. And then after the war, his parents went back to Italy because they were both Italian. But then after some time, moved back to Michigan, and all 8 of these couples ended up living in Michigan, getting together once a month for their entire lives.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how did you get into this work in the first place?
This is how long I've been doing it. When I first started, clients had to come into the office to watch the video on VHS of other clients. Yeah, I've been doing it a very long time. But how I found the job, I was actually sitting around with friends at brunch on a Sunday, and we were looking through the job ads, and I saw this little, maybe 2-inch by 2-inch job ad talking about the dating service. And
was it in a newspaper?
In a newspaper, yeah, on the Sunday newspaper. And I was just like, oh my gosh, that's hilarious. I'm going to go do that while I look for a real job.
Yeah.
And then 20 years later.
Wow.
So, yeah. I think my whole job is to have a stranger alone in a room, talk about really personal things, and then our job is to help them find someone they love who loves them back.
Yeah.
Like, all of that. Absolutely, I'm in.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, is that that thing for you? Just in terms of being personal for a second,
yeah.
Is that because love? Or is that something that you've spent a lot of time like working at or thinking about, or is that how you kind of ended up in this? Do you think?
I think it was actually just my natural operating system. Like, I've never hated anyone in my entire life.
Yeah.
Like my default position has always just been to love people.
Yeah.
And like all the way starting, I guess, out of the womb.
Yeah.
Because there's stuff in like my baby book where I just was very much an I love you person.
Yeah.
And so, and interestingly though, I've never been goal oriented to get married either. Because I do get asked that question a lot at work. They're like, well, are you married? I'm like, I have never wanted to be.
Yeah.
I haven't reached that point. Not ruling it out. But when I was in high school, girls would always talk about wanting to get married. By the time I'm 18 to 22, and I was like, oh my gosh, like maybe 28 to 32.
Yeah.
And then I got to that age and I was like, maybe in my 40s or 50s I'll get married.
Yeah.
And it's like I keep pushing it off because I just haven't had that desire.
Well, maybe because you are actually experiencing love all the time. If you're like, you know, feeling that way, or if that's what you're looking for in your life, you're probably finding it on a daily basis.
Well, and I think it's also one of those things, like you talked about too, being somewhere and you not being interested in pursuing people in the club or music venue or whatever, and your friend very much wanting to pursue, it comes to you more naturally when you're not out there pursuing.
Yeah.
So I do tend to date the marrying kind. I did, like, pretty much every relationship I've ever had eventually came to the point where that person said that they wanted to get married.
Yeah.
Whereas I've had friends who all they want to do is get married and then never end up dating those kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think there's some of that wrong end of the magnets.
Right. Yeah. And I think we probably get attracted to things that, you know, are our opposite in some ways. I mean, I think that's why some of those matches do work. But there are also things that really don't work together.
Well, yeah, and opposites attract.
Yeah.
But compatibility lasts.
Compatibility. So it's different than being opposite, really.
Yeah. But that initial attraction, people will pick something that's very different from them. But eventually, if you don't have overlapping compatibility, it's not going to last very long.
Yeah.
So it's just that initial new shiny thing that isn't like you, and you want to, you're curious, you know, intellectual curiosity makes you want to find out more.
Yeah. Is it Esther Perel? Is that how you say her name? Do you know who she is? She's French. She's done a few TED Talks, or a pretty well-known TED Talk. But one of the things that she talked about was that with your partner, she's like, the one thing that's important beyond everything else is that you each still have your independent sort of passions and explorations, and that that independent part of you is what ultimately keeps you attracted to that person. It's like seeing your partner across the room engaged at a party, laughing and having a good time and getting deep in conversation with somebody else, and you see that happening, that attracts you to that person again.
Yes.
You know, because really that's one of those things. I mean, I've been in a couple of long-term relationships now, so I know that there are these waves where, you know, you kind of keep going through those things over and over again with them. And, you know, each time it's like deeper in a different sort of way, but you have to have that independence. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, my wife and I certainly talked about early on, was that we have these things that we just have to do. We both have creative, you know, sort of things, endeavors going on the side. And that I think in some ways it is what, you know, keeps us so sort of engaged, because we talk about those things together and I stay out of that. You know, I mean, I like what she does art-wise, but that's not for me to like have any input in.
Right.
And I like that part about it. It's like sort of a separate, you know, thing that I get to observe.
And that's a mature love, whereas so often you see relationships disintegrate because it's an immature love where they almost kill what attracted them in the other person.
Right.
And they just kind of keep chipping away at them.
Hoard them.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, you see these people who really fell for a free spirit, but then that's the part that they try and like pull out of them at the same time.
Yeah.
And then that's not there anymore. And you're, you know, so it's very tough. There's not as much mature, real love in the world in partnerships, because again, it goes back to, we haven't had many healthy examples of it.
Yeah.
So, but you don't see as often as, I mean, it should be, that your partner is doing something that makes them happy and makes them successful or creative or fulfilled, and both partners can support and nudge that person to continue in that vein.
Yeah. I think about this a lot right now, having a teenager, and thinking about why these conversations aren't going on. I mean, luckily, I feel like our kids are getting a pretty good example.
Yeah.
And there are times now where, like, both of our kids are at an age where if we're being mushy with each other, they kind of get a little, or they want to come in and just hug with us,
oh,
which
I
is
love
which
that.
Is a really sweet thing.
Yeah.
But for, you know, I feel like this could be one of those like things that could be part of education to just sort of learn about this. We do sex ed, but we don't really get very deep into like the intimacy of human development with another person.
Well, and really the sex ed we do is very mechanical. I was having a conversation with a client about this years ago where they were talking about how they only tell you what sex actually is. Like, sex is putting a part into another part and whatever. But they don't teach you about foreplay. They don't teach you about how you make someone else feel comfortable. They don't teach you about how to have conversations and communication to make that a healthy aspect of a relationship either.
Yeah.
So going even beyond that, we don't do sex education in a very educational manner.
Yeah.
And then go the next step, and we're not teaching how to be intimate and how to expand to what's healthy love, and we don't talk about any of that.
Yeah.
And if you went to Catholic school like I did, there was even less of it.
Yeah.
It was, you don't do that until you get married, and apparently you would just figure it out when you got married.
Right.
Luckily, I had grandparents, my dad's parents, that grandma was very, very, very clear about the fact that sex is an important part of a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I grew up in a very Catholic strict household, and my mom's side was very Catholic strict. My grandma on my dad's side, it was very clear about it. And they were together for 64 years, and they were still having sex until they couldn't have sex anymore.
Yeah.
And she hammered home when I was probably too young to even know what sex was.
Yeah.
Just making sure that you knew that this is an important part of it, and that if you don't have it, that's not the right relationship, you know, and all of that. So that was really, had I not had that, then I probably would have had different feelings on it going to Catholic school.
Yeah. And I don't feel like men are very good teachers of fathers or whatever, are oftentimes not as good teachers of staying with those conversations.
Yeah, because it's uncomfortable.
It's a little more uncomfortable for them. And when you see someone talking about this stuff in any sort of public way, it's usually a woman like Dr. Ruth or somebody who's but it ends up being more clinical, which is okay. But I think there's also a part where people just need to understand like the compatibility aspects of it, what is healthy. And now with like, you know, this has got to be like a strange time to grow up as a teenager or a person in your 20s with the amount of online material that you can, you know, kind of get lost in and also teach you all the wrong things.
Yes.
So is that something that you have to, is there anything, any of that stuff that comes up in terms of problems in relationships?
Well, I think that if you can name it, I've probably heard it at some point from some client over the years. But I do remember a client, this is also years ago, she sent me a TED talk about, there's this woman talking about make love, not porn.
Yeah, yeah.
And how we need to stop putting out in the world that that's what actual sex between partners is like.
Yeah.
Because it sets up expectations. First of all, that it's that easy to make it all find its end goal, but also that, you know, the way they're doing things is not normally, I mean, that's porn. It's a different thing. And so then the expectations for women to do a certain thing or men to do a certain thing, and they don't live up to it, then all of a sudden they don't feel like they're doing it right. And so I remember she and I had a long conversation about that, and how she even said she was an older woman, but she needed to remind herself of that, where she is allowed to have needs and wants in that situation, and that she needs to say them out loud, because again, she came up in a generation that women don't talk about what they want or need. And if they didn't get what they wanted or needed, then that's just how that went.
Yeah.
And so
I feel like women could look at porn and think like clearly fantasy, mm-hmm. and they can kind of do whatever they want with it. Whereas men looking at it have a totally different view.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and it used to be stories probably, like men would sort of you know, have these tales.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, they still do, because I hear about this stuff from younger people, but they believe that the other person's life is always better than theirs in terms of their sex life or whatever. But that doesn't, again, that's just the act part of things, that they're not really getting back down to like what really made that, you know, a great experience. And that's where I feel like, you know, the app dating, the sort of instant, the as you were saying earlier, like the quantity versus quality thing. I think there are people who don't have any sense of what quality is like, or haven't even experienced it.
Oh, absolutely. I've also run into clients like that too, where maybe they had a long marriage and they never figured it out. And sometimes they don't have great sex until, again, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, yeah, 90s. Right. And it's the first time they figured out what they didn't know about it, and finally get it, like finally it all clicks because they're with the right person and they know how to communicate together. And that's always really interesting to hear, because they want to somehow help somebody else figure that out earlier.
Well, I mean, and I always, you know, I think there's a part of me, just from the work that I do with people, I know a lot of times what people are really looking for is, you know, even when they're having a health struggle, or they're struggling with anxiety and depression and things that I tend to treat, that they're trying to improve their experience. And so there's all these little pieces that are sort of in there, and I get glimpses of them when I hear from, you know, things that they're struggling with that I know are sort of part of their well-being, that they're just unable to kind of find that. And that's why I wanted to talk to you, because I feel like it's a very specific skill that you have. Really.
Yeah.
And it's different than a therapist, because the outcome in a therapy session that would be different, I think, would be, you know, they're working on tools. And that's why I think that's an important thing, that some of these people who are coming in might still need to do that work. But
oh, absolutely.
But
I've gotten some people into grief groups too. Like if they, you know, lost a spouse,
somebody,
or yeah, lost a child recently, or, you
yeah,
know,
yeah,
cause that's important too.
But to help somebody navigate, you know, how to really engage in a relationship and figure out what their need is from a relationship is kind of a unique thing. I almost feel like there should be more of you out there.
Yeah, well, and a lot of times therapy is what you're doing for internal work, for personal growth. What we're doing is helping someone make life changes so that they're making progressive growth.
Right.
And so that they're putting one foot in front of the other into the next chapter of their life, instead of stalled and marinating in whatever moment that isn't going anywhere. So that is also a part of it too, because the two most important things we choose to do in our life is what we choose to do for a living and who we choose to spend that living with. Mm. And so often people invest time and money and effort and energy into what they're doing for a living, and they almost have to circle back and start the whole process of investing in this part of their life because they focus too much on the professional life. So that's something we have to help people with too.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to put something out right now. I just feel like it's a very specific time with COVID and people really, you know, thinking about wanting to make these important things. What that quote that you just made is like, it's such a huge one. You know, those two pieces in our lives are most of our lives.
Right. And when you neglect one half of it, you're missing out on half your life.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Kristen.
Yeah. Thank you.
Awesome.
It was fun.
Kristen Campbell, folks. My relationships during this coronavirus pandemic feel like everything to me. The distance and the challenges of seeing each other face to face, sometimes masked, has brought so many things to light, but nothing quite as clear as how much I value these deep personal connections. And while we can't always be with the ones we love, we can still cultivate that feeling. The primary relationship in our lives is with ourselves. So say nice things to yourself. Point out the good things more often, and express positive feelings towards yourself. Feel gratitude and do something thoughtful and caring for yourself today. Go ahead, I give you permission. Improving this loving relationship with ourselves is the foundation for nearly everything we'll do and experience in every relationship we have. And if you're looking for love, there's really nothing more attractive to another person than this. Let me know what you thought of this topic in conversation. You can hit me up at any time at my email, jeremy@highway2.health. Thanks for listening and for all that you do. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.